Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. At least 35 people are dead, and that number is likely to change after a highway bridge collapsed earlier today in Genoa, Italy, during a violent storm. There were multiple cars and trucks on the bridge at the time. Here's video from an eyewitness that's being shared on social media.
Oddio! Oddio! Oddio!
You can hear the man there yelling, "Oh God, oh God." Rescue workers are now searching through piles of debris for survivors, and the mayor of Genoa said at least 11 people have been pulled out alive. Joining us now from Rome is NPR's Silvia Poggioli. Silvia, this bridge is on a main highway linking Italy with France. You've actually crossed it yourself before. What do we know so far about what happened?
Well, around noon today, during a very heavy rainstorm, the Morandi Bridge, that's its name, it suddenly collapsed, apparently after the central pylon gave way. TV images show a massive quantity of rubble that fell to the riverbed and railway tracks that are below the bridge span. Officials say that there were 35 cars and 3 trucks on the bridge at the time of the collapse.
And this bridge collapse happened over an industrial zone. What else is in that area?
Well, this highway bridge, it soars over the city. It runs over shopping centers, factories, homes, the Genoa-Milan railway line, and the Polcevera River. Genoa is really sort of an unusual Italian city. It's a major urban area with elevated highways that cut across this densely inhabited area. The highway and its viaducts are really quite an eyesore and an ugly contrast with the scenic port, an old part of the city. The highway is also the major road linking France and the Italian Riviera and vacation spots further south. The collapse today occurred on the eve of the major summer holiday. Traffic was very intense, and now cars and trucks are backed up for many, many miles, and they're being forced to take long detours. It has also affected access to the Genoa airport.
And so far, as we said, a number of people have already been pulled out alive, but the search and rescue efforts are going on. What can you tell us about that and the resources that are going into that?
Oh, it's a major effort. The TV images I've seen, hundreds of policemen and firefighters are on the ground. Rescue workers with helicopters have been ferrying the injured who have been pulled out of the rubble to nearby hospitals. Again, the TV images show workers with heavy equipment and chainsaws that they're using to cut through the vehicles that have been crushed under the rubble. The Civil Protection Agency says that so far it appears all the casualties were people inside the vehicles, on or below the bridge. No one inside buildings appears to have been affected. The Deputy Prime Minister, who's also the Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, told reporters that around 30 people had died and many, many others were seriously injured.
Now, we said that this happened during a violent storm. Do we know at this point what caused this bridge to collapse?
Well, you know, in response to reporters' questions, all the officials are saying it's too early to say. It'll require some time before the cause can be determined. So far, I've not heard anyone even suggest the idea of terrorism. You know, this being Italy, the most immediate suspicion will go to poor maintenance and or poor quality of materials used, or to lack of funds for adequate upkeep. You know, it's no secret that overall Italy's infrastructure is very outdated and that commerce is far too dependent on trucks and therefore motorways rather than on rail traffic. So there'll be a lot of questions being raised, not only certainly about the cause and certainly about what the future will be in terms of, if you've been on any Italian highway, all you see is just trucks, and trucks. And there's been a lot of controversy, the need for more high-speed railway connections for commerce. So I think that'll be one of the major topics in coming months and weeks here.
But as we said, right now, the focus is on just rescuing anybody who may have survived this, and they've already taken many people out alive. NPR Silvia Poggioli on the latest on the bridge collapse in Italy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to other news. According to the Associated Press, President Trump's campaign is suing his former White House aide and Apprentice contestant Amorosa Manigault Newman, alleging breach of a secrecy agreement that she signed during the campaign. This news comes after she released a tape on CBS This Morning. She said it's Trump campaign workers, including Katrina Pearson, the spokeswoman for Trump's 2016 campaign, talking about another tape that had surfaced on which they say the candidate uses the N-word. They say the candidate asked them for advice.
He goes, "How do you think I should handle it?" And I told him exactly what you just said, Marissa, which is, well, it depends on what scenario you're talking about. And he said, well, why don't you just go ahead and put it to bed? He said it.
And joining us now is NBC's senior politics editor Beth Fooey. Beth, this was pretty explosive this morning, and now it's followed by, well, there was a tweet from the president about Amorosa, and now news from the Associated Press that his campaign is suing her. Pretty elevated here.
Yeah, and NBC News has confirmed that as well. Yeah, it's gotten incredibly ugly, as you noted, Robin. In addition to the just kind of escalating back and forth between Omarosa and others around in the Trump orbit, President Trump himself on Twitter this morning called her a dog, which is quite extraordinary. We of course know this president is pretty fond of mocking people or using diminutive terms for people if he is angry with them or wants to settle score. But the fact that he would call her a dog sort of takes this to a whole other level.
Well, we should say it is not the first time the president has called someone a dog, but she is the first black woman he has called that a dog, I believe. And the tweet is, when you give a crazed, crying lowlife a break and give her a job at the White House, I guess it just doesn't work out. Good work by General Kelly for quickly firing that dog. And, of course, we could find sound, as others have, of President Trump praising Omarosa. This obviously has a lot to do with her being fired and with the fact that her book about the Trump White House, Unhinged, comes out today.
Yeah, I mean, and there have been other tell-all books that have come out but haven't provoked quite this level of acrimony from the president. And if you think about it, he has had a relationship with Omarosa for many, many years, going back to 2004 when she first appeared on The Apprentice. And then, of course, she came back for a couple of other iterations of that show. So clearly, she's somebody that's been in his life for a long time. She joined the campaign. We know that he expects and demands loyalty from those around him. So this probably feels like an immense betrayal to him, that not only someone he knew as in his role as a TV host and reality show star, but then transitioning into the White House with her, that she on some level owes him something, and that this is her turning around and betraying him and many things that she knows about the White House. Well, so there's that justification perhaps for President Trump, but the extent that he has gone to both call her these diminutive, very belittling names, and now for his campaign to take legal action against her has definitely made it clear that he's looking at this in a much more dramatic way than perhaps others.
We'll talk for a second about these confidentiality agreements. She admits that she signed one during the 2016 campaign. There's debate as to whether or not his White House staff was asked to sign these, non-disclosure agreements, which really make no sense. If somebody's called before Congress, they certainly couldn't hold up a piece of paper that someone asked them to sign in the White House. But she says she did sign one during the campaign. Does this mean that they're going to try to stop the publication of her book?
Well, the book is already out, and thanks to President Trump, it will probably bump the sales of the book up quite a bit, given the amount of attention he's paid to it. Look, Robin, I'm not sure it's quite the case, as you point out, that as a public official or somebody working in the White House is on taxpayer dime, one can hardly imagine that these NDAs would be enforceable. We do know that many people in the White House were asked to sign them, but at this point, most legal experts believe that they cannot be enforced because these people don't work for President Trump. They work for the people. They work for the people who pay their salaries. On the other hand, it was probably pretty shrewd of this lawsuit to go forward out of the Trump campaign, because that is a different animal. That is a private organization. If she signed an NDA, it's now on the campaign to make the case that the campaign NDA would cover her time in the White House, and now this time that she's been out of the White House for the last, 7 months. It seems it's a tall order, but one they feel that they must pursue.
Well, and as we heard this morning, she has tapes, and this one this morning, pretty damning. The staff, some of whom said, we don't know anything about a conversation about the N-word. She now has a tape in which they say they heard him say the N-word, and they're going to try to figure out how to spin that. So pretty damning there. But Beth, we only have about a minute left, and I want to ask you, we have other news today, which is that the defense team, which pretty much started its case today, has rested its case in Paul Manafort's trial. This is President Trump's former campaign chair. They're not going to bring anyone to the stand.
Yeah, pretty extraordinary, although I guess the point lawyers would tell you is that it's on the prosecution, it's on the government to make their case beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not up to the defense to prove or insist that Paul Manafort is innocent. So perhaps his legal team believes that line was not crossed, that the government has not yet made a strong enough case for the charges, and that they don't want to respond to them. They want the jury to basically come to that conclusion as well.
Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News. With a lot going on in
so
politics.
Much.
Beth, thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we introduced you to Hudson Yards, the building project currently underway in Midtown Manhattan. It is the largest private real estate development in U.S. history, and its first phase will include 6 new skyscrapers, many of which are under construction right now. They'll have 18 million square feet of commercial and residential space and 14 acres of public open space, which sounds a lot like the promise of another real estate development that used to be just a few miles to the south.
The purpose of the World Trade Center is to increase the flow of international trade. It brings together 130,000 people each day, people of business and government involved in processing international commerce. The towers are occupied by the communications, financing, transportation, and education facilities required to carry on business more efficiently.
When it opened in downtown Manhattan in the 1970s, the original World Trade Center held a lot of promise as a city within a city, the same kind of promise Hudson Yards makes today. When I visited him on the 24th floor of 10 Hudson Yards, I asked Jay Cross, the president of the project, about that. I was recently down at the 9/11 museum, and they have an exhibit there where they have an old sign that was out in front of the World Trade Center when it was up, when the Twin Towers were there, that was describing what a marvel it was and how many people were going to work there and how many, offices there would be. And as I was looking at that and thinking about this project, it was a similar dream that they had down there.
Sure. I mean, not only was it a similar dream, I think in its day it achieved similar results. So I think that what was achieved at the original World Trade Center, and I think that was a great example of a city reinventing itself and providing a brand new neighborhood. And we can look back at it today and say we might have done things differently from an urban planning point of view, but in terms of raw ambition and demand, it was a great example of what we've done here. So the really good examples are Rockefeller Center, of course, World Trade Center and Battery Park, Hudson Yards, Canary Wharf, Roppongi Hills in Tokyo. There's a few. There are not a lot of them.
Are you worried about being a target the way that the World Trade Center was?
I think any large development today has to be concerned about that. I'm not even sure if you're a large development yet to be. I think, what we've seen in Paris and London doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a high-profile target. So we devote a lot of time and energy to security. We want people to feel inherently safe, but we don't want people to feel like they're in an armed camp.
When we think of the construction of skyscrapers, one of the images that comes to mind is those guys sitting on a suspension beam, eating their lunch.
Yeah.
How different is it to build one today than it was almost 100 years ago?
Remarkably, it's not that much different. I mean, you would like to think that with the advent of technology, we would be building differently today, but we really don't. We have tower cranes, and you know, it's a race to get to the top of the structure, and then you've got to get the first elevator running, and the glass wall systems have been around since the 60s, all slightly refined, but basically built with the same trades, same labor component.
I imagine the safety standards have changed.
Safety's changed a lot. And so I was going to say the one thing that has changed is that the safety is dramatically improved. I mean, knock on wood, we have never had a really serious accident on this job yet. And we've employed 20,000 workers to date. It's a pretty extraordinary safety record that we hope to take all the way through.
We're actually sitting in one of the new buildings right now on the 20-something floor.
24th floor, 24th 10 Hudson floor, Yards.
10 Hudson Yards. How many people right now are working all around us on building the rest of this complex?
So any given day, there's roughly 4,000 workers on site. This building we're sitting in houses 7,000 office workers.
So already.
They come to work every day here.
Dressed in suits, not construction.
Well, not very many in suits. So let me tell you about the office worker here. So this is a brand new Class A building, and 70% of the 7,000 workers are under the age of 45, and 50% of them are millennials. And there are only 7% that are old gray-haired baby boomers like me in this building. It's an extraordinary workforce.
You're proud of that, it sounds like, that there are so many young people working in this building.
Yeah, we think that this has really become real evidence of what we set out to do, which was to build the new workplace for the future, like to build new modern buildings that to emphasize collaboration, emphasize light, de-emphasize authority, and so really making the space responsive to a young worker has been our goal. So we've got 7,000 workers here today, and by the time we finish next summer, we'll have 40,000 workers a day here. That's going to be an amazing place.
A project of this size has its critics. Some are unimpressed with the design of the skyscrapers themselves. Others question whether you can recreate the vibrant, organic nature of New York in a planned development. And there are many who worry about what all these fancy new buildings will do to the already sky-high cost of housing. I asked Jay Cross what the biggest challenge of this project has been.
Well, it's hard to say. The challenges, you know, vary over time. So in the beginning, it was convincing people that we could pull it off, we could make it happen, and get our first, you know, commercial tenants. So Coach, SAP, L'Oreal were all pioneers in the early days. But then once we got momentum going, the momentum started to build very quickly. And I think one of the new challenges then became, like, how do we find all the capital? It's $16 billion being deployed out there right now. And nobody had ever raised that kind of money in that short a time frame in one place.
How did you find all that capital?
Well, we had to go around the world, basically, and lift up every flat rock and every capital source there was. Because in a post-recession world, the American banks had limits on how much they can invest in one company, how much they can invest in one project, how much they can invest in one geography. And so it meant that these big buildings, which require, in general, billion-dollar loans, had to be sliced up into $75 million pieces. That's a lot of banks. So that was a challenge for a while. I would say the last challenge is now today we're leasing a lot of space, we're selling a lot of units, and you know, we're marketing as hard and as fast as we can.
And we're about 10 years into an economic recovery. Are you worried that all of a sudden something terrible will happen in the economy and it could put some of the development that is yet to come at risk?
Well, I think one's always worried that the economy is going to have ebbs and flows. But I think that when you take on a project like this, you have to build into the fact that over 20 years, you're going to hit one or two recessions. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think we went into it, you know, Pollyannish in that respect. And I think we've been lucky that we actually started in the recession. We were able to get good construction pricing because everybody was hungry for work. All that's changed in the last few years. So that momentum we've been aided by. It's been a wind at our back. But I think the other side of the coin is, unlike some of the big, big projects in the past, like Canary Wharf, we're extremely conservatively financed. So we're probably only 50% debt, 50% equity. Mm-hmm. We've insulated ourselves. We're not industry specific. We have the leaders of media, the leaders of fashion, the leaders of tech, the leaders of private equity, the leaders of hedge funds, the leaders of banks. I mean, we're in every major industry type in New York, and I think we've got a lot of built-in resiliency there.
Okay, it's going to be plenty noisy for the next 5 minutes. It'll take us 5 minutes to get to the top.
5 minutes to get to the top.
Close enough.
We board a metal cage elevator on the side of the tallest of the new skyscrapers, a 1,296-foot tower that will open next year. It's made of glass, and near the top, there's a platform that shoots off the side of the building. When it opens, it'll be the highest outdoor observation deck in the Western Hemisphere. As we step out onto a cement floor, we can see all of Manhattan. There's a hole in the floor up ahead, and that is by design.
That'll be glass. You'll be able to walk on that and look straight down.
So who in their right mind would want to do that?
Some people.
Just look down through the glass.
Yeah.
How many stories down?
100,000 feet.
Wow.
Also in view, the new World Trade Center down at the southern tip of Manhattan. Cross took me up a set of large metal steps.
You're on the edge of the world.
This is like the modern day image of that picture of the guy sitting there having lunch on the top of the beam.
Exactly right.
Unbelievable. And this view, I mean, this is the first time I've ever seen it. Do you still get amazed by this?
Oh, yeah. The view, you can never get tired of the view. It's just so exceptional. There's the Statue of Liberty. There's downtown. You can see the Verrazano Bridge. You can see the ships coming and going. You get a sense of the traffic in the bay. You get East River, Madison Square. You know, that's Midtown. It feels like a model that you can reach out and touch.
I feel like a little kid playing with your blocks or something.
Yeah, exactly right. This is very much for the kid in all of us. It's really like a playground in the sky.
This playground in the sky is expensive. The total cost of construction for Hudson Yards is $25 billion. That's three times the estimates for the new World Trade Center buildings and three times the cost of the city center project on the Las Vegas Strip. 30 Hudson Yards is just one of many skyscrapers currently going up across the U.S. The 1,186-foot Vista Tower in Chicago, the 579-foot Capitol Tower in Houston, and the 1,100-foot Wilshire Grand, which just became the tallest building in Los Angeles. Jason Barr is a professor of economics at Rutgers University and the author of Building the Skyline. He says the Hudson Yards project tells us something about America in 2018.
In many respects, it represents the ability to cater to work in the 21st century. Much of the growth in the American economy is taking place in older urban centers like New York. So to the extent that a place like New York can continue to grow and continue to accommodate the kind of growth that's important to the 21st century, then I think that's important to the United States as a whole.
The question now is whether all the promises being made will be kept, that Hudson Yards will actually become a vibrant new neighborhood overnight, that it'll have a positive effect for people who aren't wealthy, and that it'll eventually survive its first recession.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Temperatures in Seattle will reach into the mid-80s today, as they will in many other places. There will be air conditioning in office spaces, but not at the architecture firm Weber Thompson. 10 years ago, the company built their new headquarters in Seattle's South Lake Union neighborhood without air conditioning to prove it could be done. And now they use about half the electricity of a traditional office building. Joshua McNichols from member station KUOW went to see if they stay cool.
It's 85 degrees outside, and inside Weber Thompson's glass and steel building, it's 78 degrees. I notice you're sweating a little bit. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I did walk back briskly from a lunch about 3/4 of a mile away to get here in time for this. So that's really why I've got the glow going.
Kristen Scott is a partner at Weber Thompson. And she's fine with talking about her glow because she believes air conditioning tends to cut you off from the outside world.
you forget how hardwired humans are, I think, to really enjoy the natural environment and how much respite you take from being connected to nature, even when you're in an urban environment like a city. Those opportunities become really precious.
Connecting with nature means making some compromises. Like, this office has a casual dress code. People here wear shorts. Some even wear flip-flops. But you can't just take a regular modern office and remove the AC. I mean, this building was designed to stay naturally cool from its very inception. The office is shaped like a donut, with a courtyard at the center, lined with windows you can open.
And then the perimeter of the building has other operable windows.
When you open the windows on both sides, the courtyard becomes what's called a thermal chimney. It sucks up air and pushes it into the sky. That draws a breeze across the office, and it all happens naturally, without power.
It's really like being under the shade of a big tree outside, and you've got this gentle breeze washing over you. So yes, it's warm, but it's comfortable because there's air movement.
This four-story building was built to show off these features. The workers here are totally into it, but selling it to others has not been easy.
I guess I have to say that we have not succeeded in having another project without air conditioning. And that's mainly, I think, because while we're very focused on sustainable design, and the new projects are also, they're larger buildings.
Meaning the office spaces are wider, which makes it harder to draw breezes across them. Also, you can't do this without the central courtyard. Most developers aren't interested or able to leave a chunk of unrentable space in the middle of their building. Climate change may be another factor. When the firm ran temperature simulations before this office was built, they estimated the office would be truly too hot for human comfort about 20 hours a year. Now, that's climbed to around 30 hours a year. One day last year, the outside temperature reached almost 100 degrees. So the firm set up a kiddie pool in the courtyard, and everybody got a popsicle. For Here and Now, I'm Joshua McNichols in Seattle.
I love a story that ends with, "and everybody got a popsicle."
The Turkish currency, the lira, rebounded slightly today after going into freefall following President Trump's announcement that the U.S. will double the tariffs on Turkish steel and aluminum because Turkey is refusing to release an American pastor being detained there. This is just the latest example of how the Trump administration has been flexing U.S. economic power to pressure other countries to change behavior. The U.S. is imposing new sanctions on Iran and Russia and is considering increasing tariffs on Chinese goods. Joining us now is Sebastian Malaby, who is the Paul Volcker Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's in London. Sebastian, welcome.
Great to be with you.
And do you think that Trump's use of tariffs and sanctions to put pressure on other countries to get what he wants is working?
Well, up to a point, there's no doubt that the U.S. has enormous power to inflict significant economic pain on other countries. This was true before President Trump was president. I mean, after all, Barack Obama led the allies in imposing sanctions on Iran's oil sector, and Iran's oil exports promptly fell by more than half. So this isn't a new thing, but the U.S. does have, I think, four distinct advantages in imposing this kind of economic pain on others. First, it's got the world's biggest economy measured by market exchange rates. Second, it's got an enormous current account deficit, so it's always importing more than it is exporting to the rest of the world. So there's more stuff that the U.S. can sanction than others can sanction the U.S., and you're seeing that in the China fight. Thirdly, the U.S. is extremely open to foreign investment, which means that any major global company has huge operations in the U.S. and therefore cannot afford to alienate the U.S. government. And finally, the central role of the dollar in the international payment system gives the U.S. a particular lever it can use to choke off payments to other countries.
I guess it's not so surprising to watch the U.S. wield its power in Turkey, a much smaller economy. But it's surprising to see what's happening with China, because this is the world's second largest economy in a fight economically with the world's first largest. And people have been saying for years, oh, China owns so many U.S. bonds, they would have a lot of cards in their deck if there were to be a fight like this. But it looks like the U.S.
is saying, actually, you need us to buy all of your stuff, and if we're going to put tariffs on it, it's going to hurt you more.
Yes, I think that's right. I used to believe that by selling U.S. bonds, China could drive down the U.S. bond market, drive up interest rates, and cause a sort of Lehman-style financial crisis. I think the problem with that theory is that we've learned from the 2008-2009 experience just how powerful the Federal Reserve is. So if the Chinese were to dump enormous amounts of U.S. treasuries, the Fed could simply print money and buy them. And it's such an extreme thing for the Chinese to try and do that, you know, I'm not sure we've gotten to that level of tension for them even to be thinking about it. So you're right that when the war is confined to tariffs, the U.S. does have the upper hand because the U.S. is importing more from China than vice versa.
And what do you think the goal is when it comes to China from the Trump administration? Are they trying to weaken the government there, which is obsessed with their economy growing at a certain rate?
Well, that, I think, is where you get to the weakness of the Trump strategy. It's clear that Trump can inflict damage and economic pain on others, but will he get the political objectives he seeks? And that's actually a very different question. I think both with respect to China and with respect to, you know, Turkey or Iran. It seems to me that with China, if what Trump really wants is for the Chinese to give up their ambitions to take over the high-tech sector, I don't think the Chinese are going to give that up, no matter how much you put sanctions on them. Nor are they going to give up the Chinese Communist Party's monopoly on power. So it seems to me that although there can be the appearance of progress in the sense that you can put pain on the other side, whether you get your political desires is a different matter.
Do you think that in the case of Turkey, that the U.S. is going to get what it wants and have this pastor released?
On the one hand, it seems to me that releasing the pastor is sort of a small concession for the Turks to make. And when you balance that against the fact that their currency is in free fall, you know, any rational leader of Turkey would make that trade and do what the U.S. wants. The problem, though, is that it's not clear how economically rational Turkey's leadership really is. I mean, you've got, you know, the president, Erdogan, who's installed a relative of his to run the Turkish Central Bank, and who appears to think that, you know, if you raise interest rates, you'll create more inflation. And that's a view that's about as popular with economists as the notion that the world might be flat. So I think it's a bit unpredictable how this plays out just because of the obstinacy and the economic obtuseness of the Turkish leadership.
Now, Turkey is one thing. China is another. Then there are Trump's economic fights with our closest allies, with Canada and with Europe. What do you think are the benefits and risks of that?
Well, that's where it gets completely crazy to my mind. I mean, I understand that China is doing some things with respect to forcing technology transfer from Western companies to Chinese ones, which really don't count as playing by the rules, and sort of using pressure to try and force negotiations on getting China to change. That you can make a case for that. But when it comes to Europe or Canada, close allies, which are not obviously abusing any kind of rules, it really doesn't make any sense at all. And it's good that last month in July, the US seemed to de-escalate its fight, at least with the Europeans, and say that there would be no further trade sanctions placed on Europe, and even that the US would work with Europe to try to get some reforms to the World Trade Organization. So that was a good thing. On Canada, there's still this fight going on. It's sort of connected to the NAFTA negotiations. I don't think the cost-benefit on that from any strategic calculus is appealing.
Do you think that that's what this is about for Trump, that he is trying to flex the U.S. economic muscle as he goes through these NAFTA negotiations to say, you've got to play ball with us the way that we want to do it, because look how much it'll hurt you if you don't?
Yes. I mean, I think he does have the instinct in almost any relationship with any other country, and this goes for North Korea, where it's about nukes rather than trade as well. You know, there's this combination of playing tough and, you know, tweeting against the adversary and threatening them with annihilation and so forth, and then at the same time offering negotiation and this kind of, you know, good cop, bad cop routine, but combined in the same cop all at once. seems to be the Trump negotiation method.
Can you think back to times when this has happened before to this degree?
I think the use of trade tools, trade sanctions, both for foreign policy reasons, like trying to contain Iran's nuclear program, and because of trade disputes. If you think back to the 1980s, a lot of trade sanctions on Japan because of its alleged violation of international trading norms. There's a long history of this. What's different this time is the way that Trump, in his first year, certainly unleashed this battle on all fronts and has continued this into his second year. That's the strange thing. It's kind of going after everybody at once. If you wanted seriously to take on Chinese abuses, you would first make nice with Canada, make nice with Europe, and build a global coalition to go after China and put pressure on them, instead of which Trump bashed everybody he could see and also went after China. And I think what's interesting to see in the next sort of 6 months or so is whether the de-escalation of tension with Europe is followed by a de-escalation also with Canada, and you start to see the emergence of a kind of coalition to single out a couple of targets, which might just be, for example, Chinese technology policies on the one hand and the Iranian nuclear ambition on the other.
But it sounds like what you're also saying is that there is a risk that because of the way that the U.S. is acting with other countries, it may be difficult to get that coalition together down the road when you need them.
Yes, I am saying that. And I'm saying that, you know, the question is whether Trump changes his tactics. He's done that a bit with Europe already. That has not happened with Canada, but it might do. And then you'd be, you know, moving into a zone where you could start to make a rational explanation for U.S. trade policy. I'm afraid I can't make that yet, but I'm not ruling out the possibility that it might be possible in 6 months' time.
That's Sebastian Mallaby, who is the Paul Volcker Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. Sebastian, thank you.
Nice to be talking to you.
Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones is having a hard time finding a welcome on social media. After weeks of public debate, companies like Facebook, Apple, Google's YouTube finally banned Jones and his site InfoWars, noting the posts that contain ugly hate speech and lies like the theory that the Sandy Hook shooting victims were actors or 9/11 was carried out by the government. Over the weekend, without access to YouTube, Jones made a push onto the video platform Vimeo, but Vimeo said it didn't want him. There's just one place that Alex Jones has a home, and that's Twitter. Throughout all of this, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey has defended not banning Jones, saying he didn't violate their rules, to which Recode's Kara Swisher wrote in the New York Times. Translation, Twitter is doubling down on the same squishy point of view that has allowed too much of it to become a cesspool over the last several years, and it has little intention of truly cleaning things up. Well, let's take this up with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Boy, Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. People have just been ferocious in their criticism of Dorsey.
Well, Jack and Twitter have been really the last platform that still allows Alex Jones to operate. And so Twitter has a long history of really defending this idea of free speech. And, you know, when Jack Dorsey came out last week and said, Alex Jones has not violated our rules, but all of the other companies found that he did, it kind of opened himself and Twitter up for criticism. So, yeah, he has definitely taken a lot of heat over the last week.
Take us through the timeline here, because Jack Dorsey defended the company's stance. Then he said it's up to journalists to knock down misinformation, which some saw as passing the buck. And then he later seemed to blame his communications department for not making Twitter's policies clearer. Just take us through some of what's happened here.
Yeah, so it was a week ago that Jack Dorsey first came out. He did a long Twitter thread to defend why Alex Jones was allowed on the service. The high level was that he said Jones had not yet violated Twitter's policies, and as a result, he was allowed to continue to use Twitter. A few days later, there were some journalists, I think Oliver Darcy over at CNN, who combed through Alex Jones' Twitter page and actually sent a bunch of tweets to Twitter and said, hey, look, these very clearly violate your policies. What's going on? The company did kind of acknowledge that some of those tweets were against their rules, but said that most of them had been published at a time when Twitter had different rules. So it's been a very complicated thing where people have said, hey, look, here is evidence that he's not following the rules, and Twitter is still saying, well, those were rules that we used to have, not the current rules that we have today.
Well, how much is this complicated by the fact that Twitter is the main message service of our current sitting president? I mean, this is speculation, but how much are people speculating that Dorsey and Twitter might be uncomfortable about banning someone for violating a rule like, let's say, threatening violence, when you have the president of the United States who's used Twitter to threaten violence against whole countries?
Well, I think it's very clear that Twitter is afraid of alienating this, you know, very, very conservative group. That's what it's called. Really, in some regards, it's a group, I think, that's probably crossed the line. At the same time, it has said in the past that President Trump gets, you know, basically special treatment on the platform, and that because he is the president and everything he says and does is newsworthy, you know, they're going to kind of hold him to a different standard than everybody else. And what I think that does, unfortunately, is it creates this approval for stuff that maybe would have otherwise been violated. You know, even if, you know, it makes sense that the president shouldn't be kicked off Twitter because he's the president, he kind of provides air cover, if you will, for other people who probably are skirting those rules a little bit.
Well, and Kara Swisher reports again for the New York Times that's the claim from Twitter, that what the president says is news, so they have to report it no matter what it is. And she says that her sources at Twitter tell her that there is a pull emergency brake plan for him if there's something that President Trump says that is just too much, even for Twitter. But just briefly, Kurt, what are some of Twitter's rules that apparently they don't think Alex Jones is breaking? What are their policies?
Basically, you can't promote violence, you can't attack, you can't threaten anybody based on their race, their sexual orientation, their gender. That is the kind of stuff that we have seen Alex Jones do in the past, and that is where this conversation has focused with him.
Yeah. And by the way, Jack Dorsey went on Sean Hannity's radio program, and he said one of the concerns that Twitter has is that they don't want to be accused of what he called shadow banning. Is that a real thing?
Well, shadow banning is this idea that someone can continue to tweet and use the service, but all of their tweets are falling on deaf ears. No one is actually able to see the content, right? So even though you think you're participating, you're actually, you know, banned or being punished in the background and no one's aware of it. Twitter has said, no, we don't shadow ban, but that has been a big point of contention, especially for conservatives right now, because they feel that their voices aren't necessarily being heard and that these platforms, many of them, you know, from California, from Silicon Valley, are left-leaning and therefore stifling Republican voices. I don't think that's actually the case. I think what we're seeing from Twitter is almost a very dramatic reaction to try and prove that they're not doing that.
Right. Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. Kurt, thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.